One of our most famous exports to Australia, the politician Joe Bjelke-Petersen, had a famous reply to journalists with curly questions. I'm glad you asked me that question, and I'll be referring to it later in my answer. David Longhi had an even more effective response. Seizing on the original troublesome query, he would proceed to ask a series of questions that seemed to develop organically from the original inquiry and that appeared to anticipate his interlocutor at every point. But as his answers rolled out at machine gun speed, the listeners were carried to a different vantage point on the issue at some considerable distance from the original difficult question. Anyone who's been in public life for a while must attempt to develop the survival skill of the clever, multivalent answer to career-wrecking questions. Answers which appear to address the issue at stake, but which are capable of a variety of interpretations, none of which can be pinned on you later as the defining one. Surprisingly, John Key, though one of our most successful politicians, often struggled to master this art. He tended to be either too honest or too vague. During a visit to a Christchurch factory, he was asked by one of the workers how come he only bothered to show up during the election campaign, to which he replied that he had a good point. Then there was the famous question about whether he'd been for or against the Springbok tour. At first he couldn't remember, then he conceded he was mildly for it. Looking for the signs that heralded the beginning of the end for the long reign of Margaret Thatcher, commentators have pointed to the poll tax riots. Having vanquished her enemies one by one, having gained from the British public either supine acceptance or sullen acquiescence in her rule, she turned to the apparently routine matter of simplifying the manner in which local body rates were levied. Cutting through complex calculations about how much you should pay according to how much property you owned, she proposed that everybody should pay a standard charge. This was the spark that unexpectedly ignited a broad cross-section of opinion who were as mad as hell and who weren't going to take it anymore. Across the country, widespread demonstrations turned nasty. Some city centre districts took a battering. The police struggled to gain control of rioting on a scale with what had occurred in Brixton and Bristol in the late 1970s. The government had received its first major setback. The Roman Empire would have been surprised by and sympathetic to Baroness Thatcher's difficulties. Among its bevy of taxation measures was the poll tax levied on every subject of the empire between the age of 12 and 65. They had to pay a denarius, the equivalent of a day's pay, to help foot the bill for the legions and the roads they marched on. The entrapping choice put before Jesus was, tell people to pay the tax, in which case you fought out with Jewish nationalists, or tell people not to pay the tax, in which case you fall foul of the Roman authorities. Quick-witted master of the art of verbal repartee that he was, Jesus of Nazareth served up an answer this morning on the subject of church-state relations that has had us scratching our heads ever since. The important thing was that it got him off the hook with those who were trying to force him to take sides with the collaborators or the resistors of his day. The wisest heads that have pondered this passage conclude that the messages extend a limited cooperation to the powers that be, but let me direct your attention to where your ultimate loyalties lie, to the one who has the biggest claim on our lives. The governments we live under, whether those of the Emperor Tiberius or of Jacinda, make it crystal clear what they expect of us. Their revenue-gathering arms are one of the main agencies of executive authority in our lives. They claim the right to intrude into many aspects of our lives. Jesus counseled limited cooperation with the tax-gathering agencies of his day, but his reply pushed his hearers and us into considering another and bigger issue. Exactly whose authority are we living our lives under? When we've given the state its financial due, what about all the other areas of our life? Are we totally free to do whatever we want to do, or does God have a claim on all those uncharted domains of personal existence? For several hundred years now, people's lives have been shaped by the claims of modernity. They valued their independence and autonomy. They believe that they are free to pick and choose about how they will order their lifestyle and about how they will assemble the bits and pieces of their personal belief system. What I do in the privacy of my own home is my business is a motto of our time. For our secular neighbours, questions about ultimate reality, religious faith and personal morality belong in the private domain. No one, they believe, has the right to challenge them about that or to claim their allegiance in these matters. Are we, who belong to a community of faith, any different? Acute observers of Christian behaviour in Western culture have pointed out to the contradiction in our lifestyles. It's this: the claims of modernity extend even into the household of faith and make religion a leisure activity instead of the centre of our lives. We come along because we like the singing and the sermons and the people. It's a rewarding part of our free time, but how much deeper does it go? Do we believe that anyone has the power to tell us what to do about the quality of our religious lives? Do we think that the community of faith has the right to challenge us about our lives, full stop? Are we like our secular neighbours, believing in a little bit of this and a little bit of that, in a kind of uncritical reflection of the current orthodoxies of the spirit of our age? Or to put it in the language of Jesus, are we able to render to God the things that are God's? Do we allow God to have the same sort of authority in our lives that the IRD has? That's the key question. Ceding that kind of authority to the Holy One in our midst means living an ethical life in which God is sovereign over our conduct. It means being generous and merciful in our dealings with others, remembering that God provided everything we have in the first place, and that His forgiveness of us is the starting point of all our other relationships. It means staying in contact with God through regular prayer and worship. It means participating with enthusiasm in the community life of the church. It means believing in the faith of the church and not just our private version of the gospel. It means taking part in the struggle for God's reign of right relationships to begin on earth. That's some of what it means to place ourselves under the rule of God. Those gospel words about taxes and political authority have a certain timeliness, given the present uneasiness of governments across the continents about the possibility of another imminent global financial crisis. As fear and uncertainty spreads, I think of the message that St. Augustine of Hippo had for the Christian world when the stunning news broke about that the barbarians had sacked Rome. "There are two cities that really matter in this world," he wrote. "There is the earthly city, the place where the struggle for power and wealth and status and security goes on incessantly. That is what Rome was, and there'll always be a city like this, where our acquisitive instincts and dominance needs rule the roost. Violent conquest and the collapse of empires and man-made hopes will always be a part of their story. Then there's the heavenly city, the New Jerusalem, which we Christians are intended for and towards which we are journeying on pilgrimage. Here we have no continuing city. We are heaven-bound exiles here, people who don't have any permanent roots or essential interests in this passing phenomenon called history and the world of time. We must pay our dues to the powers that be while retaining no illusions about their very limited authority. Our true allegiance is to God and His church. What matters is which city we belong to. To whom have we given our ultimate loyalty? We show this by what we desire, by what we want, by what our hearts go after. The pattern of our desiring shows clearly where our loyalties lie. Be therefore citizens of heaven by desiring not power, sex and money, but rather love, joy, peace, patience, gentleness, generosity and self-control. Prepare yourself for the new political reality of life in the heavenly Jerusalem, where it will be safe and appropriate to give a straight answer to a straight question, and where there will be no further need for weasel words and for politicians' answers.